Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
You know, the calendar is working in strange ways. The calendar works in mysterious ways. Because, as we said a couple weeks ago, we sold out. We are part of the tool of the man now, in that we put a calendar item down for when we record the podcast. And I just want to point out that for two straight weeks now, we have not recorded at that time.
But don't you think there's a element of proactivity? You know,
now that it's
on the calendar, it feels like a thing. Therefore, when we realize, oh, we must reschedule it rather than just waiting for some unspecified time to occur, we're a little better about, you know, making sure it gets done.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was going to say, is that it is happening because we put it on the calendar, even though we aren't actually doing it at that time. Because having it on the calendar makes you think, like you sent me a Slack message today that basically said, hey, can we do it a little earlier tomorrow morning, my time, because you gotta head out. And then I was like, well, I'll be sleepier if we do it earlier than 9 a.m., but I'm free now. And you're like, oh, okay. And so now we're doing a podcast now. So the existence of it on the calendar for you to see it and go, oh, right. Like, you might have thought, oh, well, I got to get out early tomorrow. So do you want to record this thing? But putting it on the calendar makes it that much more kind of straightforward that we're going to do it that way.
Yeah. And I don't want this to minimize in anybody's view the amount of time and preparation we put into this show, because clearly we are... You know, we just spend a lot of time collecting all sorts of news stories and really thinking hard.
That's right.
So that we can have these conversations. We wouldn't just do them off.
There's no off switch for us. We are always thinking hard.
That's true. We're not a C-3PO.
It's hard to think.
Lean over and flick them off whenever you want.
But we're thinking hard. This happens with another podcast I do where we have the Tea Talk Machine. It's 1 o'clock on Friday. We never record at 1 o'clock. It's amazing when we record at 1 o'clock on Friday, but we both have it down as that's when we're going to do it. And then on Friday morning, there's an email that's basically like, well, what are you thinking? And sometimes it's not one is good. And sometimes it's like, well, I'm going to be this, or I've got a lunch. I can't do it right at one, but I could do it at 1:30. And, you know, we just having it on the calendar basically means unless somebody steps up and says, I can't do that time, it's going to be that time. And that makes somebody step up.
And it's the joy of a show that doesn't have any external dependencies, right? Like, you don't have to deal with more than two people.
Yep.
Because as soon as you add a third person, ask me
it's
how
worst.
I know, things get more complicated.
You and I both host shows with at least two guests every single week, right? It's,
right.
Yeah. And then you've got Arrowcast where you've got John
right.
and Guy and, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even if you have a show with regular hosts, sometimes you can't agree on the time.
Yeah. And you got the Rebound with John Moltz
and
sometimes Lex.
Yeah.
we made the same joke at Lex's expense. That was great. It's hard because it's you know, you got to get and having a consistent time is the best I've found. Like, I think it's better to say, let's just do it at this time, and then everybody agrees, and then people can drop out or you can move the time or all that. But, like, it is way better than just every week having to go through the same, so when can you do it kind of thing.
Right. And you have this is not a show with external dependencies in the sense that, like, you and Mike do a show that's only two people, but you have a certain value to having it at the same time every week, both for your own schedules and for the scheduling of shows
it's
and
true.
People who tune in live, right? So, you know, that makes a difference. Clockwise could move, but it has a value to having it at the same time every week.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I agree. So, and the secret podcast can just float around a little bit, but it is still useful to have something on the calendar. So we've sold out. This Apple Bloomberg chip server security story is fascinating.
What a wild story. I wrote about it a little bit this morning, and then I was just, right before we started this, I read John Gruber's take, which I think aligned pretty well with what I was thinking about it, which is, you know, the fact that Bloomberg has put this story out. And Bloomberg is not a fly-by-night publication. They, especially because this story seems to be their cover story for their latest, I don't even know if it's a physical issue or not, but, like, they're really promoting the heck out of it. Bloomberg Business Week, sorry. Yeah, and you're not gonna do that with a story that you, in theory, haven't really made sure is pretty watertight. So they seem very confident about it. Yet, Apple and Amazon have vociferously denied the things that they are suggesting, like contradicted the things they have suggested, which, as John said in his Daring Fireball post, you know, either somebody is wrong or one of them is lying. And that's a weird situation to be in, because there are credible things coming from both of these places. And I don't know how you make the determination in this case where the fault lies, like what is incorrect or what is misleading, because there are some, I mean, my biggest problem with the Bloomberg story is that there are no named sources, really. And that is kind of a function of how we do things now. We're much more willing to give a pass to things with no name sources, but it seems like several of those people should have been on the record.
Yeah, the challenge, so they've got, they said multiple senior sources at Apple who say that this happened. And as you and Gruber both point out, like, look, Apple PR spins, their job, I once had a senior Apple PR person, who I will not name, who is no longer there, say, my job is sales, right? Like, they are, PR is to put the best foot forward for the company and get the company's positive message out there. That said, Amazon and Apple both issued basically blanket denials saying this is not accurate. And I don't think I believe that Apple PR would blatantly lie, like what Gruber said. I think they spin. Of course they do. But to say this did not happen is because, you know, if somebody comes out on the record or shows proof and shows that they're lying, then that's just a flat out lie. I don't think that's the case. Now, could they be obfuscating in some way? Or because then you could just say nothing. You could just say nothing, or you could say something weaselly, but they didn't do any of that.
I don't think they could have gotten away with saying nothing in this case, if only because the allegations were so severe and credible that it seems like to let it go unanswered would be like tacit acknowledgement.
You could say, you know, you could be weaselly. You could be like, we are always concerned, and we always are checking on hardware and updating our procedures.
Yeah, I mean,
and working with the appropriate authorities, and it's not appriate for us at this time to make a comment beyond that. Right? They could have done that.
If you want to know what that would look like, you would read the super micro response, which is far more kind of like, oh, we're, you know, we don't know that we've ever lost customers because of this thing, right? Like, it was a textbook dodge and spin, and that seems like what that would have looked like. But they gave, both Amazon and Apple gave lengthy responses that mentioned specific figures and facts that were incorrect, which is unusual for Apple. Mm-hmm. Apple does not delve into that kind of specificity usually in their responses, even if they are rebutting something that they is untrue.
The thing that I wonder, and going back to the anonymous sources, is they say like several people at Apple told us that this was the case. The problem with that is that's all we really know, is that several senior people at Apple said that this happened. And are they in a, we don't know anything about them. Are they in a position to know this? Because just because there are people you have inside Apple who tell you a story saying, oh, did you hear the story about how we got a bunch of these servers that had Chinese stuff in them? You should write a story about that, right? Do those people know that? Or was that through the grapevine? What, did they get some of their facts wrong? Are they mixing up, as Apple's statement seems to suggest, an incident in 2016 with the thing that's being reported here? Like, the problem is, just because there are people inside Apple who told a story to a Bloomberg person saying that this happened or that they heard that this happened, like, we don't know if they firsthand saw it or firsthand dealt with it.
Right.
In fact, it's probably most likely that this is a story that went through the grapevine.
Right.
It's entirely possible that the people inside Apple who revealed this information to Bloomberg don't actually know what they're talking about, got something distorted secondhand, and so then you're ending up saying, well, on the one hand, Apple has a direct response to the allegations in this article and says it didn't happen. And on the other hand, I've got some people inside Apple who heard that it did. It's like, well, like, I don't know. It could be. Could it be that the Apple PR statement is just a lie? It totally could be. But it's
unlikely.
It seems more likely to me that Bloomberg sources got it a little wrong. Like, there's a little legend inside Apple about this thing that happened that's been embellished, perhaps, that was not entirely clear, that was maybe a couple of incidents being conflated, that Bloomberg is taking as a fact because it helps buttress their story, because this is a big story with art and all this stuff, and a lot of it is less, it's more of a so what story if Amazon and Apple aren't headlining it.
Right, because then who is this actually harming? Who has actually been affected by this? And I think the only rationale I have for if Apple's statement were an outright lie would be something along the lines of a national security concern. But again, to your point,
they'd finesse it, right?
Why not equivocate?
If the U.S. government said you can't talk about this,
right? Why would you spend so much time defending it? Yeah, exactly. That would be because eventually that would come out, and they would still look bad. And I don't think Apple is in a position where they feel necessarily that they have to kowtow to the government in terms of that.
They could have said a lot less too, just to reassure customers, yeah. Right? The fact that they went this far seems to me to be way more than just we want to reassure customers that their data is safe. The story's wrong.
Yes,
and we tried to tell them it was wrong, and they wouldn't listen to us. They weren't interested in hearing what really happened. They felt like they had, which the way they're playing it anyway, leads into that same kind of interpretation, which is that as soon as somebody at Apple said that this happened, they were convinced 100% that absolutely happened, and no reassurances to the contrary would make them believe otherwise.
You know, in theory, this is why you have multiple sources that should be able to corroborate it. So maybe everybody heard the same weird story. But like at the same time, usually if it's that vague of a story that went through the grapevine, you would think that different people heard different versions. But you never know. I mean, again, the problem with unnamed sources is we don't know their positions, we don't know their motives, we don't know their biases. We can't judge any of that for ourselves. And that goes the same for, they interviewed a bunch of people, including people they described as former U.S. officials and former like administration officials, former intelligence, I think, and FBI sources. And it's like, some of these people should be willing to go on the record if they no longer work for those agencies or the administration.
It may be classified or something like that.
Right.
So they don't want to do that. But again, just because they have people people in the Obama and Trump administrations who want to talk about this doesn't mean that they're not thinking of another issue that they were giving a vague. This is the thing about reports like this is like we partially because they have to obscure it because they're anonymous and partially because of just it would be super boring, bad storytelling. It's not like there's a footnote where they say, here's exactly what this source told us. They can't do that. And so they end up kind of obfuscating the whole thing
and cobbling together a bunch of different viewpoints and trying to make them line up.
Yeah, we don't know. Like, the story doesn't say we talked to three people in three different parts of the government who said that this very specific thing that we're reporting happened. They're like, oh, well, we talked to some people who said this happened, but it's not like, what did they say? Did they say this specific thing happened, or they heard a thing about how Apple got hacked or how Apple had a hacked server in its premises or was it Apple? I thought it was Amazon. Like, who knows? Right. And because they're all anonymous sources, it's very difficult to get that together. Anonymous sources are super valuable, and it's entirely possible that these reporters are like, why is everybody suppressing the truth on this? There's something fishy going on here. Well, we're just going to report it. Of course, they're going to deny it. And that may well be. It is the vociferousness of Apple's and Amazon's responses that make you go, or was it, right? Like, why would they go to that extent to deny this if it was true? They would soft pedal it instead.
And that said, I agree with Gruber's assessment that nothing about this story, and I am not as technical as I'm sure some people listening to this are, but nothing about the story says to me it's totally implausible. Yeah, that's the thing, right?
I believe that this is happening, right? I think the problem with this is a really interesting story, and we've heard issues like this before, but it's a really interesting story that is getting muddied by the fact that some of the details may not be accurate.
Right, and it's a lot less sexy when you don't have Apple and Amazon, as you said. I think that's totally true. But like the fact that the Chinese government almost certainly trying to influence the supply chain, the fact the supply chain is so rooted in China, you know, they were so dependent on China for building these products.
And that technology has gotten to the point now where you can build something that looks like a capacitor that's actually a microprocessor or something that you put in between the layers of fiberglass on the motherboard.
Oh, it's just nuts.
And stuff like
that. We were
that
just talking
great.
About that in another Slack. Where I think was John Siracusa posted something that we were looking at, talking about payment terminals that people were trying to compromise.
Oh my God!
I don't even know what the sourcing was on that, but it was crazy if true. Where it's like we tried to do this, and like then we started weighing them to see if they'd added chips. They started shaving plastic off to try and make it match the weight. We started like using angular momentum to try and figure out like if they were the same precise, you know, mass or whatever. I mean, it was just. Wow, that was just, I mean, and I have no trouble believing that any of that is happening.
Yeah, it is. And those, that was the, we don't really have show notes for this podcast, but there is a tweet in the timeline. It's ARBEDOUT, Arbidoubt, and it's one of those tweets. And it's when your supply chain is so pwned, you have to rely on your adversaries not to be able to cheat the laws of physics. And the text, it's a screenshot, says is, I worked in the card payment industry. We'd get products from China with added boards to beam credit card information. Devices were modified on the production line, most likely by bribed employees. And as soon as they're closed, they have anti-tampering mechanisms.
Right.
So it's not possible to open the device to check it without setting the tamper flag. Once we noticed, we started weighing the terminals because we couldn't open them. They learned of this, so they started scraping non-essential plastic to offset the weight. So we ended up measuring angular momentum on a special fixture. Yeah, and this first off, it's great, like a science fiction, techno thriller like kind of plot.
Yeah,
thing.
It reminds me of the Cuckoo's Egg a little bit.
That part's really awesome, but of course, it's also really scary, the idea that this kind of stuff is going on, not just in software, but in hardware. The supply chain is a super political issue now, too, where, you know, the President of the United States is often like, why are we even building things in China? We should build them in the U.S. He wants to make trouble with China. This is yet another thing about that. Although I will point out, bribery on a production line can happen. Anywhere,
sure. Anywhere people need money.
Yeah, and you know, anybody can do it anywhere. But it's still fascinating, even if Apple isn't involved. And the idea that if you're at Apple or Google or Facebook or Amazon and you've got a huge cloud, you've got to. I mean, I read about this in the context of Google and Facebook building their own servers. That
right,
part
sure.
of the reason they build their own servers is because they do want complete control over what the pieces are that are put in them. And, you know, the danger there is then the components get flaws and introduced into them. And you've got to keep doing that. But if you want to be secure as a cloud service provider, you have to have your own security and you have to be very carefully monitoring every single device. And they already do this, but they're going to have to keep stepping up their game. Every single device that gets brought into your cloud, let's just say that your data center, I guess, is the way to put it. Every single piece of hardware. But the idea that you might have to start like x-raying every piece of hardware to see if that capacitor is a capacitor or not, and like, it's bananas. It's great from a storytelling perspective and super scary from a security perspective.
Yeah, it's going to make everything cost a lot more, too, if you have to do that.
Yeah, right? And I could see somebody making the argument, again, that this is why you need a tighter supply chain. And the fact is, even whether it's in Asia or not, the fact is that one of the reasons electronics cost what they do is that they're made by people who don't get paid a lot of money. And that means that they're open to bribery. And we talk a lot about the bribes although there are bribes involved. Bribes and it's, you know, to get things out of the supply chain for rumors. We talk about those rumors all the time.
Yeah.
And guess what else can happen when you do that? Things can walk away. Things can get added. Parts can be changed. All of those things can happen if you've got a scenario where the people who are working are, you know, it's worth the risk to them because they're getting paid by some outside actor. And if you want to make it more secure, there are a few ways to do it. I'm sure Apple already like is patting down everybody on their way in and out and makes them change clothes in the locker room and, you know, their factories in China. I'm sure that's already happened and has happened for years. But, you know, this keeps on happening. Then what about the supplier? You've got a supplier. Now, do they have to have that level of security? Are they going to take the bribes? And you can move it to the U.S. But again, my point is, you know, that people might
nothing is perfect.
Nobody is not bribable, and no security system is invulnerable. And you know, this is it's fascinating and it's difficult. And yeah. So regardless of whether this actually happened to Apple, the fact is Apple and Amazon and Google and Facebook and everybody else, they have to be aware of this and fighting against it all the time. Like if Apple didn't get infiltrated by these things, it's because Apple checked them and found them, you know, and said, we're not going to even work with these people. Or they got a call from some other company, said, yeah, they're compromised. Or the FBI came to them and said, you can't use these. They're compromised, right? Like that, because I actually was struck by the fact that Apple says that to their knowledge, there's never been a hardware hacked item, and then they check every item over. And that's the part where I was like, that seems unlikely that you didn't ever find anything ever. It seems more likely that perhaps there is a back channel where key American companies get alerted by government officials basically saying this is compromised, you can't use these parts from this factory or whatever it is. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, a lot going on there.
Yeah, crazy. That's what else I wrote my Apple Watch review this week.
Yes, well,
I've been working on it for a while, but I posted it this week, so now it's there.
I had to go to a doctor's appointment today, and my doctor asked me, my doctor's an Apple fan, or at least one of my doctors,
right? I know that
asked me about stuff. So he asked me about the new phones, and I said, I think the watch is a little more exciting. He's like, oh, is that the new watch? And we talked about the watch for a minute. He's like, oh, it looks bigger. I was like, oh, it is a little bigger, but, you know, it's the screen, all that. But, yeah, I agreed a lot with, I think the thrust of your review was spot on, that this sort of weird invisible upgrade thing, right? Like, you know, if anybody were to just glance at my Apple Watch, I feel like...
It's an Apple Watch.
Would not, yeah, no one would immediately say... I mean, it looks different to me, but like, I don't know if that's just because I'm really attuned to it or what. But yeah, no one would really remark upon it, I think, in the way that when you first got an Apple Watch, right, everyone's like, oh, that's clearly an Apple Watch.
Right.
But now it's just like there are so many of them out there that it just looks like another Apple Watch.
Yeah. Yeah. The way I thought of it is two things. One is the band compatibility is interesting, like, because you remember on that day, our last day as a full-time employee of IDG, when they announced the Apple Watch, like, immediately we started to think, how long is this thing going to be out there? They're selling all these watch bands and stuff for it that they're going to do. Like, does it all break in a year? If you buy a edition watch at that moment, is it all like worthless the next year? And
no, the answer is 3 years later, your edition watch is worthless because
you
can't update it anymore.
That's right. But for the bands, I was thinking about it like, well, you know what? Apple wants to make money from people upgrading their watches, but Apple also wants to make money from selling all of those accessories and the bands and stuff. And maintaining band compatibility is a good example where, like, you know, in the end, you are going to want to buy a new Apple Watch every 3 or 4 years anyway because of the advances in the technology. But if you can continue to spend freely on bands in the meantime,
sure,
because you know that the band compatibility remains, that's good for Apple. Like if they broke band compatibility every year, it would suppress band sales, and I think, why not keep it compatible? So even though they changed the sizes of these things, they kept the band compatibility,
right? And they've been very clever about the way that they handle bands, right? Like they make them kind of a seasonal thing.
That's right.
And when they go away, they get like kind of in demand, right? Like I saw a bunch of people talking on Slack last week or two. It was like, oh, I never got that purple fluoroelastomer band when it's around, and I'm really sad. And on eBay, they're all super expensive now, and there's a whole market there. There's a whole third party economy.
It's a fashion thing too, where it's like, here are the spring Apple Watch bands, and it's kind of cool. I like it. And then you could step back and take that for the whole device, which is, you know, a lot of people have been speculating since that day about, like, when do they change this up? Do they make it look very different? Do they make it look round? What do they do with it? And I feel like we've actually gotten to the point where the Apple Watch has been so successful that it's in Apple's best interest to keep the Apple Watch looking like an Apple Watch. Like, I feel like it's come all the way back around, where if it had been kind of lagging, there was a hilarious, by the way, I sent a URL of it to the Macalope. This is how well I thought of this article. A New York Times piece about the Apple Watch. This is basically like, well, the Apple Watch is a flop. This is from like today. It is so stupid on so many levels, and I'm not gonna fisk that article here. Macalope, I suspect the Macalope is on it. That's the impression I got, that the Macalope has got it already in the Macalope's list for next week. But I just think that's wrong. It is not the iPhone. I think that New York Times article falls in the whole idea of like, well, they said it would be like the next iPhone. They didn't say that. But it is the number one watch, right? And it is the number one smartwatch. It's the number one watch. It has been very successful. It's got lots of room to grow. It's not for everybody. There's a lot more to be done. But I think it's been successful to the point that it is a brand now. It is the Apple Watch. It has a look. And so if you're going to make a complete redesign like they really did with the Series 4, that's why it's invisible, is because you still want it to look like an Apple Watch, because there's value in the look of the Apple Watch. Now
there's value in
something
in the idiosyncrasy of it, in the same way that I think, was it Marco that wrote a piece when the iPhone 10 came out about the notch and about the iconography, essentially?
Yeah,
how when you reduce it to a shape, it's immediately knowable, like, oh, that's an iPhone because of the notch, even though the notch itself seems like a design flaw in some ways.
Yeah. And then all the Android phones are like, we could do a notch too. Like,
right, okay. Exactly, which is hilarious. But yeah, I mean, the Apple Watch is the same way, in the same way that we all thought, oh, maybe it should have been a circle. But like 4 years later, you're like, well, it's, you know, it's an Apple Watch. That's what it looks like. It's clear. You don't have to change what it looks like. In the, I think Jeremy Burge pointed out that though they did update the iPhone emoji in 12 or in 12.1, that the Apple Watch emoji still basically looks like the original Apple Watch emoji. You know, and I think we're in for, maybe someday they might change it eventually. But
sure,
I think I can see, you know, reasons that they would keep it the same as we've discussed. Like, I think they'll try to keep making it kind of thinner and sleeker, but I think the circular watch shape thing is, I don't think that's happening anytime soon.
Yeah, I think they are gonna, the Series 4 feels like a pretty major, again, invisible and yet pretty major design shift that I imagine they are going to ride for a while now. And so this, and also I just like it from the pure kind of poetry of it, that it's a round rect, you know, it's a round rect.
Yeah,
it is the shape of an iPhone icon. Yeah. It is a shape that means Apple, right? So it's not just that it's a square, it's a round rect. It is an icon. That's the point. So I wrote a piece, kind of stemming off of my review, that was a Macworld piece this week. It is just a little inside baseball. Every now and then I write something and I get to a line and I think, well, that's the line. I would say that's the line that somebody will quote. But honestly, in my mind, it's always John Gruber. It's like, that's the line Gruber's going to quote. And it's usually that I write it and it's a turn of phrase and I'm like, oh, that's a pretty good sentence. But instead, I think that's the line that Gruber's going to quote. And so I wrote this piece for Macworld. Partially based on John's positive response to my review and the part of it in the review that he quoted about the faces, just about the faces. And the whole idea, the premise is basically, I understand why Apple wants to have a monopoly on watch faces for lots of reasons. It would be great if there were third-party watch faces. They could be heavily curated. But I also get the idea that maybe Apple just believes the faces are the province of Apple. They are really the definitive part of what makes the Apple Watch the Apple Watch, and Apple wants to control that, and the complications are where third-party developers go. Okay, fair enough. But watchOS 5 is pretty good. You've done a lot. You brought the platform a long way. You don't really have the excuse anymore. Faces are a mess. Like,
yeah,
if you're gonna be a monopoly on faces, you got to do a better job. That's the less nice way of summarizing my Macworld column, which is faces are a disaster. Like, the infograph faces have the new face designs, the new complication designs, but although they updated the old faces for the new display size, they don't use the new complication style. They use the old complication style, and they're incompatible, which means a whole bunch of Apple-written complications don't work on Infograph because Apple couldn't get its own complications to be compatible, which is bananas. Like, how is it that you can't put a messages complication on the Infograph face? But they didn't do it. The sunrise sunset complication, you know, it's not there. There are some other ones, but like, they're not they're not consistent. This is why if you've got an app that hasn't been updated yet, you can't put its complication on Infograph, because it's the old style. They didn't write a compatibility thing. I get that it might look a little weird to have an older, kind of simpler icon on the fancy new faces, but it would be better than what's there now, which is nothing.
Right.
And then to top it all off, what I found the other day is I was going to write a thing and I was going to say, well, my whole plan was that I was going to say, well, you know, I understand that this is more complicated because the old faces are a different size than the new faces. And so there's not room for the new complications. And then I took screenshots and I put them on top of each other in Photoshop. And I discovered that the utility face, which is my favorite watch face, the circle of the dial of the utility face is identical in size to the circle on Infograph. They're the same. The hands are exactly the same. The only difference is one of them uses the old style and has numerals around the clock face, which I like. And the other one is the new style and doesn't. And I can choose one or the other, but I can't do both, because even though these faces are exactly the same size, they didn't update the one to put the new complications in, and so it just doesn't do it.
It's a baffling choice. I really don't understand.
They keep adding new ones and not really updating the old ones, or at least not to speak of, which, talking to friends of ours who are software developers, we did a lot of had a conversation about this. Some speculation here. One, the Faces team on the Apple Watch, it's probably like one person. And that person probably gets taken off to do other things from time to time. That's a theory. Maybe it's more than one person. I don't know. Feels like it's one person or less than one person. Two, my guess is that, this is just completely a guess, is that the technical foundation that is required to build a watch face is a mess. And not only is that why there can't be third-party watch faces, but also like, that's why every time they come out with they're like sticking a new face on, but they don't really do much to the old faces. I get the impression that, I mean, like, that's a bad sign, right? Like, they keep adding faces, but they don't go back. They didn't add compatibility. It's just, and anyway, I'm ranting here. That was my point of the Macworld article, is look, if you're going to take control of this, you need to do it right. And right now, as much as I love the Apple Watch in so many different levels, the faces are embarrassing. They're embarrassing because you can't just keep adding new faces and let your old faces rot. You need to like be consistent across your whole device. And they are not. They are not even close. It's really embarrassing.
Yeah, and I mean, I like what they've done with the new complications.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot in there that I like. There's still stuff where I think it falls a little short. Like, I now finally have like a timer complication on the Infograph face, which is what I've been using. And I love that it shows you the timer, right? Like, as it's going down, it's got a little bar if you put it on the outside, and it gives you like a little, like, you know, progress bar essentially. But I dislike that the complications itself never do anything more than opening the relevant app.
Yeah.
Where it's like, why can't I just, it says a 5-minute timer, even when it's not in use, why can't I just tap that and have it start a 5-minute timer? Why can't I, or, you know, force touch it or long hold it, right? Like, it seems like now that you've opened up these complications that are truly more useful, you need to make them more dynamic as well.
Well, that's the other piece of my Macworld piece is, if you're going to control the faces and the complications are the primary way that users interact with apps, which I think is true. I think complications as app launcher is the right way to go. I think Apple has figured that out. Between that and pressing the side button to get your recents or favorites, like, those are the ones that can run in the background. That's what's mm-hmm. going on here. That's great. That's fine. But if you're going to do that, the developers need to have more power in those complications. And that's another thing, like, complications don't update, aren't allowed to be updated very
right.
often. So, like, people were asking for a now playing info thing for Overcast, right? And Marco says he can't really do that, I think, because he can only update so often. So if you're moving through podcasts, he can't just like instantaneously update it. It's stuff like that, that it's just, okay, Apple, I get why you limit access to complications for apps, because you're worried about the every single little bit of the Apple Watch is about conserving power, because it's a really small device with a really small battery. But this is probably an area of need more focus. And again, I feel like maybe I understand how we've reached that point with watchOS 5, because there was a lot to do for watchOS 5. WatchOS 5 really added a bunch of stuff. It really enabled the platform to be way better. App developers have access to more stuff. Very happy with that. Great. More like, okay, you can't do anything else until you fix the faces now. Like, that's the next thing to fix, is right. Watch faces. And if there's a big, maybe there's a big overhaul coming in watchOS 6 that will include third-party faces, or dynamic faces, or the whole face architecture is being overhauled behind the scenes, and the reason that they're not doing a lot of work up front is because they're doing
it's
lot of work.
It's a multi-year thing.
Yeah. Why invest a lot of effort in fixing all the faces now, when next year they're all going to be based on a new platform, and they're all going to be new and way better? That may be, but again, I don't know that, and if I had a dollar for every time we expected something glaring and obvious to be fixed in an OS release the following year, only to have it be not addressed at all, I would retire. Now, okay, no, I'd have, like, I could buy an ice cream. But well, anyway, it happens all the time.
It's funny that you mention this, because I'm in the process of finishing up my Macworld column for this week, which is about the HomePod, and I think the HomePod is a... it's a different version of the same story as the Apple Watch to me, because it has similar things where you feel like, why, this is kind of a mess. Why doesn't this work better? And some of them are central experiences to the HomePod, to the device itself. But where it kind of differs is that I think the Apple Watch, obviously, when it came out, was, as we've discussed before, they didn't really know what it was. It was, you know, it does everything, right? Whereas the HomePod, that messaging was much more tightly controlled, but it was arguably too tightly controlled, right? Because it was so focused on things like music. This is a speaker. We're here to play music and have it be like an Apple Music device. And maybe it does some home automation stuff. It actually did more stuff than that, but like, their messaging was so constrained that they really didn't manage to kind of, and I don't sell, quote unquote, you know, not in the necessarily just the financial sense, but like as a story, as a message, they didn't manage to quite sell it. And so I think there's something similar happening there, where, you know, and the HomePod is obviously much more early days, but we finally, you know, we got an update that added some features that felt like, okay, those are features actually based on people's usage experience over the last 6 months. So we're starting to think more about, like, what is the next major update to that looks like? What maybe does the next version of the hardware look like? What are things that people are prioritizing? But yeah, it's, I think the HomePod and the Apple Watch are in similar states in that way, because they're not the top tier Apple products, right? They're not the iPhone. They're not even the Mac, really.
Yeah, totally not.
And so, you know, they kind of put them out there to stake this ground, right? We have a smart speaker. We have a smart watch. But they're there more as like almost placeholders in this larger ecosystem until people figure out exactly what that ecosystem is. And the Apple Watch has been showing us that that ecosystem develops, that message develops, right? Like, they've got a much clearer idea today of what the Apple Watch is than what it was 3 or 4 years ago. It doesn't mean they've executed entirely on that, but every subsequent update moves us a little closer to a more a device that's more what it should be, like that's living up to its potential more. And some of that means a lot of the stuff they hacked together back in the early days, like you said, hasn't necessarily been brought up to speed in the same way, because it was good enough for now. And it's quickly becoming not good enough anymore as these devices become more and more capable. So I think the HomePod might follow a similar trajectory, and I'm kind of fascinated about that too.
Yeah, I think we talked about it here, but I use the HomePod way more than I used to. So I think that it's been, like, the stereo pair was a big difference for me in kind of embracing it as a music source. And the new features are good. I still have my Amazon Echo Show around. Apparently it's going to get that software update when the new Echo Show comes out that actually makes it a better use of the display, which is great, because the software is unchanged since I bought it.
Yeah, mine's unplugged on my in my office here.
I'll tell you, you know, having the screen is good in the sense where we use it now because, one, it shows you your timers, which is nice that you can look. You don't have to keep asking about the timers.
Yep.
And two, when we do things like add an item to a shopping list, it shows you the shopping list and the item, so you can right. kind of visually confirm that it is actually what you said and that it really did add that to the list. Also, I'll point out, and this is a place where the HomePod just isn't there yet because it's just not smart enough. And it's a little like Apple Watch in the sense that first thing we do is we tie it tightly to your iPhone. Yep. The next thing we do is, tying it to an iPhone is a problem and we need to not tie it to the iPhone anymore. It got us a lot of things, but now we need to back off of it. I can't set up. There is any list support on the HomePod for Siri.
Oh, right.
Here's the problem with it. It is tied to Siri, so I have to say, "Hello, lady. Have any list add this item to my grocery list?" Right. So I have to put an extra set of parentheticals in there, basically, to tell it sure. what app to yep. use. But the big thing about it, my phone's not around. And Lauren asks it to add something to the list, it won't, because it's actually talking to my iPhone, not directly to the cloud. Whereas the I almost said her name. Oh, no. Whereas the Amazon Echo version, you log in and say, add this app. Here's my username and password for my AnyList account. Connect. Done. And now anybody in the house can add things to the shopping
right.
list
yep.
to the Echo,
we
and it shows up. It's great, right? So that's why the Echo will not get unplugged for us. And the Echo Show, yep. we are still using it. I don't use it to watch TV. I don't use it for, to watch YouTube videos. I don't use it for any of those things. But it still has enough value that I will not replace it with another, like, screenless Echo. Nor am I going to buy the new Echo Show because it is stupid.
Fool me once.
I want them, yeah, seriously. If they would do anything... like literally anything. In fact, I would love it if I could, play. I can play a show on Amazon Prime Video on it while I'm cooking, but that is so limited. Like, if it truly had like a little bit of an app platform or at least a video view, if I could make it into a Fire TV, so I could put on Netflix or whatever I wanted on it while I was cooking, I might actually do that or stream Major League Baseball or something like that, but it doesn't do any of those things. So it's in the corner.
I gotta be honest. My HomePod is currently, I had done this a while back and then, I disabled the wake word on the HomePod and basically it's a dedicated AirPlay 2 speaker now that I occasionally tap the top and ask it to do something, but usually just out of curiosity about whether or not something works. And the reason I did this was because it's in my office, which you see my office is adjacent to the living room.
Yes.
And I had a bunch of people over to play some games the other week and it just kept getting false positives.
I'm watching TV
so
and I keep hearing that chung, that yep. that kind of bassy chime when it means like I didn't understand you. And I'm like, oh boy.
Yeah, and so here's and my suggestions are, I mean, obviously the Echo and the Google Home, neither of those are immune to false positives. They happen. That's fine. I am surprised a little bit that the HomePod seems quite so bad. But to me, my big question is why not do something like on the iPhone where they essentially have you train it like very quickly? Or heck, why not use those voice prints you've already created with the iPhones in your house and have them somehow imported to the HomePod so it knows to only respond to people who have their iPhones in the house? Granted, your guests can't use it, but like, yeah, there's a benefit to that.
Yeah.
Or have that be an option, whatever. But either way, it seems like there are ways to potentially reduce the false positives.
Yep.
And
well,
I will turn it back on after I do so. But.
Number one is going to be voice print, right? Number one is going to be if it knows exactly whose voices are allowed and whose voices aren't, and it's like right. Face ID, it can actually
do it properly.
And
it should do that because, as we discussed before, there's also only single person support for it currently, right?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
If you, as you say, like if you leave the house, Lauren can't use it. If I leave the house,
like, oh, this is great. I can do any list. And I was like, oh no, this is pointless because if I'm not here, nobody can add anything to the shopping list. That's stupid. Like that's stupid. So it's funny. I was talking to an Apple PR person when I was going down for my briefing about the watch and the phone about HomePod. And I said, I'm using HomePod a lot more. And we were talking about it. And this is the compare and contrast, which is Echo can do more. HomePod is nicer, but Echo can do more. And this is the push and pull here is like, if you've ever added a skill to an Amazon Echo, oh my God, the skill experience is a disaster. It's awful. The whole like store, or you have to click on some things on a web page and all that. It's like, it's so unfriendly, but You do have access. It reminded me of like this.
Most
is like
of them are terrible too.
It's like the App Store model versus a completely unregulated software download sideload model, right? Which is most of them are terrible, but there are some that are good. And the fact that the AnyList has an integration is great because I use AnyList for our shopping list, and it's great, and it's a very good shopping list, and it's on all our phones, and it's on the Echo. Hooray, right? But it is also a mess, and there's no way to know where to get started. And so essentially what you do is you sit there and wait until you say, oh, I wonder if I can get my Echo to do this thing. And then you go search for it, and
right.
You either find something or you don't. Whereas,
or you find you can cobble something together.
Right.
Maybe.
But on the HomePod front, it's like, well, if Apple doesn't build it, it just doesn't do it. Or now you can have an app that, or a shortcut that can be
right.
run to your phone, but only the one phone. And like, so it's we'll
and shortcuts
see.
Are kind of limited too, so
yeah, they both need to get better. If I were to say which one I had more confidence in getting better, I would actually say the HomePod, because I think Apple is motivated to increase the capabilities of the HomePod, and at some point that's going to have to involve kind of like cloud apps, cloud service apps, connections that don't force you to be attached to your phone, or some kind of agent thing where having an app on a phone basically like that's tied to the device gives the device credentials to go log into the same web
right.
service, something
sure.
like that, maybe how they do it. So it might still be tied to apps, but not to your actual device. But I have more confidence that Apple will do that because they need more functionality and versatility in HomePod than I do that Amazon is going to suddenly turn around and have an incredibly immaculately curated way to add skills to the Echo.
Well, I mean, they're not going to dial back, right? They're not going to remove stuff that's already there,
no,
I feel
but
like.
And
Amazon
they could create a more clean,
sure,
well-lighted kind of like
experience.
Interface for it. But do I think they're really going to do that? No,
it felt like Amazon, you know, the Echo ramped fast and has plateaued to a certain degree, whereas the HomePod has ramped slow but hasn't reached its maximum potential.
Totally, totally. And that's, I mean, a function of those decisions, right? Like Amazon was
sure,
like, open
absolutely.
It, everything, anybody can be a, although I'm still frustrated. I'm gonna get it out again. I am frustrated by the fact that Amazon does not have a very simple skill builder that's based on web data. That where it's the equivalent of like if this then that or something like that, where I can go to a page and say, here I'm logged in, here's my Echo, I want to take this URL and speak it or parse it in a very simple way and then speak it when I ask this question of my Echo. And like, you can't do that. If you want to build a skill, you have to write code and host it on a server
somewhere where it can run. You can do some if this then that stuff,
you can,
but it's
you can,
kind of limited.
Or I think you can do, yeah, I mean, it's super limited though. Like,
yeah.
And
yeah.
that's one
it's
of the
all
challenges.
Based on third party stuff really, unless you want to write code.
So that's my disappointment, is that there is no easy way to cause I can do this. Like I have, cause I was thinking about like, it's my weather station again, right? Like there's a web service URL that says what the temperature is at my house. I would love to be able to say, hey lady, what's the temperature? I can't without writing a giant piece of software that runs on the server all the time and is queried. But it's like, why Amazon? Why is that the only way to do this? Can you not make this easier for people?
Yeah, I wanted to do something similar with shortcuts where I was like, oh, well, I have a sensor in my office that's on HomeKit that tells me what the temperature in the office is. And in theory, I should be able to get the temperature outside and just ask a shortcut, which is it warmer inside or outside? No, that's totally impossible right now in shortcuts without doing like a whole long thing, because nothing returns data. Like they don't really design, they're not programs, right? Like they're not really programs. They're macros mostly.
I bet I could do that.
I welcome you to try. The biggest challenge is you can't get the sensor data from HomeKit from shortcuts from the home app.
No,
there's only one action for HomeKit, as far as I can tell, and it's run a routine. So I guess maybe you could create a scene that's like gives you the temp. No, you'd have to do some crazy hacking.
What you
stuff.
Need is for the maker of your sensor to have their app have Siri shortcuts.
Yes,
in
and
it,
it's
right?
Yeah, it's Hue, and I think there is some Hue stuff, but I don't think there's just a retrieve. And yeah, it's
because what
weird.
I would do is I would do a web query to my weather station and say what's the current inside and what's the current outside and then compare them. I could do that.
Sure, right. I mean, it's simple in theory. It's just it's not really something it's designed to do. I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, oh, this would be interesting. I wonder if I can do it. And the answer is probably, but it will probably be a lot harder than you thought it was going to be.
This is near record length episode of The Secret Podcast, but you know, we skipped so many weeks that I guess this is the apology episode. And I feel like in the last 20 minutes, we have really shifted over into classic Secret Podcast, which is just us talking about,
can we do this thing?
The Amazon Echo, which is, you, to be fair, that was your brand to begin with. I came along later, but you were there. I mentioned you when I was talking to somebody about the early days. Oh, it was at that Apple PR thing. We were talking about how, you know, Amazon, it was right after Amazon released like 90 different products, like the microwave, or they announced all those Alexa enabled products. I said her name. Shh. And I said, well, you know, Dan, the Echo was one of those where they didn't know if that was anything, but it was just a product they released. And I gave you credit. I said, you know, Dan Morin, he got that. And he's like, I think there's something here. And he was totally right. So you were the
I was right about something.
You got there. But I feel like this is classic now, which is why I'm also going to throw in, I'm going to give a little Homebridge update. We don't have any theme music. This is not a segment, but I want to give a Homebridge update. I updated my Homebridge to add a couple more plugins, and I added the Nest plugin, and I added the I'm going to look it up now. It was another third party thing. It's the Logitech Harmony remote plugin.
Oh yeah, okay, sure.
And I made a scene. So I have a good night scene that turns off my front light, turns off my living room light, and turns off my TV. And it totally works. So that's awesome. And nice. Then, the way it works. So Homebridge, for people who don't know, I wrote a piece on it in Six Colors that you can find, but, it makes things that aren't HomeKit, HomeKit. It runs on, you have to run on a server. So you have to run it on a Mac or a NAS. If you've got something like that in your house, you got to have something that's on all the time. And so since I have a Mac mini server, I'm running it on that. And so all of the activities in the Logitech Harmony remote are display in HomeKit as switches.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is great, right? So I don't know if you did this with yours, but like I finally got it to work where if I say, hello, lady, turn on TiVo, it runs the TiVo on and it turns on my TV and it does all the things. And if I say turn on Apple TV, it does that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That I've got that working with the Echo and the Harmony. You can do that straight out with the Echo and the Harmony without any adaptation.
So I got that working on the HomePod now. So that's
nice.
Cool.
Okay.
That's cool. The one that really blows me away, though, is the Nest integration. Because the Nest integration, yes, I can tell my HomePod, hey, gentleman with the top hat, because my HomePod is a British butler.
Yes, same with mine.
My normal Siri is an American lady, but my HomePod is a British butler.
They're all British butlers.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, I like to mix it up.
That's fair.
It means I know who's talking when the British butler talks. It's like, that's the HomePod. But so HomeKit or not HomeKit, Homebridge takes Nest and exposes it as multiple items, which is really clever. So it's not just thermostat, and I can say set the thermostat to 70 and it'll do that. Right. But it puts in an occupancy sensor because there is an occupancy sensor built into the Nest where if it senses movement, it flips on. And then after a while, if there's no movement, it flips back off. And you can do that to do like if the home is occupied, then do this. You can just use that. So you can use the Nest occupancy sensor for HomeKit things. And then there's because mine has a fan control, so it can blow the fans in my heater without turning on the heat. I just have a heater. I don't have an air conditioner. That's a separate control, so you can turn on the fans
Similar to the Hue sensor I have shows
and the
up
eco
as...
mode too is a switch, and it's like eco mode for the Nest, but you can turn on eco mode from HomeKit. Which is, that's super clever. They found a way to expose every single feature that they could get their hands on from Nest for HomeKit.
Yeah, that is clever. The hue sensor I have shows up as three different sensors.
Uh-huh.
A motion sensor, a light sensor, and a temperature sensor. Now, HomeKit is pretty limited as to what you can do with any of that information, but a listener, I believe, of one of my shows, I can't remember which one where it came up, pointed out that the Eve, formerly Elgato,
right,
which has now moved into sort of the home automation market full force, their app lets you address that and build rules and triggers based on that. So that's pretty clever. I've been looking at that a little bit. Again, I haven't come up with a really good routine or thing that I want to set up, but that was always my problem with using it in the Hue app. Was by default in the Hue app, it was like, oh, I can have it turn the lights on when the light drops beneath a certain threshold.
Right.
However, it still required you to have motion sensor functionality, really, unless you went through their like their sort of beta web interface. And so it would turn off again after no motion had been detected. And it was like, this is the exact opposite I want, because sometimes I sit at my desk for a long time and don't move enough to trigger it.
Right. That's cool. Anyway, Homebridge, people who have a bunch of stuff that isn't HomeKit compatible, you gotta check it out. Even if you want, honestly, I think it's so great that if I had needed to buy like a cheap, like a Raspberry Pi or something just to run Homebridge on, I'd consider it. I'd consider it because it's really nice to not have to replace all of these items that are not HomeKit compatible to get them to work with my HomePod and my Home app. It's nice.
Nice.
I like it. I'm surprised somebody maybe has, but like that's what somebody should do is they should build like a little box, a little plastic box that they sell that's the Homebridge bridge box. But
I guess you gotta
do some command liney stuff to add the stuff in. It's not super friendly, but I love it. All right, well, we've talked enough. I think you should have a good weekend, and we'll be back perhaps even next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific, perhaps not.
Possible. Could happen.
Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.